Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Schools are closed. You can't take the kids to work. You can't afford a babysitter. What would you do? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday. It's the 10th of September. Good to have you here, of course. 29,000 teachers, 350,000 kids, and a giant mess in Chicago. The first school strike there in a quarter century. But you get beyond the dollars and cents, the performance standards, and everything else that's on the negotiating table. And what you've got is a whole bunch of parents trying to figure out what to do with their kids now that they can't go to class. Sheila Coleman is one of those parents. She's a single mom to a 12-year-old daughter. Ms. Coleman, it's good to have you with us.
Glad to be there.
So tell me, first of all, what you're doing with your daughter today. I mean, it's a school day, right?
Yes, it is. Today, she's just at home today because I really didn't have anywhere for her to go because I have to be at work at 7:30. They said they have programs open from 6 to 12, but that's not good enough for me. I work 7:30 to 3:30.
Sure. So you left her at home?
Yeah. Today I left at home, and I'm probably going to have to stay home tomorrow with her.
So when you were thinking about leaving your daughter at home, what kind of economic calculation did you make? Was it I need to take a vacation day, or can I afford to hire a babysitter, or, I mean, did you have to do the math at all?
Yeah, I mean, I can't afford a babysitter. I can't afford one. I mean, I had to think: should I take this day off from work, or is she gonna be okay? I was up to 12 midnight
trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Wow. And up at 6 this morning to go to work, right?
Yeah, up at 5 this morning to get to work.
Up at 5. And you multiply that by the parents and families of 350,000 kids in Chicago, and it's a whole big mess.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah, are you angry?
Somewhat, because I think the kids should be in school. They just got back to school a week. It's only been a week.
Tell me about your daughter. Is she a responsible girl? She's going to be all right?
Yes, she is. She's very responsible, but I don't leave a 12-year-old by herself.
Yeah. What's she doing? Is she sitting home watching TV?
Yeah, but she was saying she didn't want to strike because she don't want to have to make those days up in the summer.
Sheila Coleman in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
dealing with the teacher strike. Ms. Coleman, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, so how's this for the Wall Street word of the day today? Bailout. You like that one, huh? No, not a new one, but a move toward the end of an old one. The Treasury Department is going to sell off $18 billion worth of stock in AIG that it got during the financial crisis. Assuming all goes as planned, it'll be the first time since 2008 that Washington is not a majority owner of that big insurance company. But untangling bailouts is no easy thing, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains.
Ernie Patricus got to AIG as a top lawyer in 1998. He sees some similarities to the firm's smaller size then and what it looks like now after 4 years of federal ownership.
It almost is taking AIG back to when I joined it. It's just back to where it was.
Patricus left before the bailout, and he's watched as the Federal Reserve and the Treasury have bought and sold big chunks of AIG.
The Fed comes out of this making tons of money. Treasury's going to come out of this making tons of money. And the AIG shareholders come out of this having lost a lot of money. But I guess that's the nature of bailouts.
It's not just AIG. The government still owns about a third of General Motors and almost three quarters of Ally Financial, which used to be GM's lending arm. TARP, the bank bailout program, still exists.
This notion that we are a free market economy is a little bit of a fantasy.
That's Cornelius Hurley. He's the director for Boston University's Center for Finance, Law, and Policy. He also says, don't forget housing.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are still owned by the government. However, unlike with AIG, there is no plan on the horizon to divest those interests.
And it won't be easy for the government to end that bailout.
Those two federally owned enterprises are the essential props for the entire housing industry.
Hurley says that despite efforts to end the bailouts in an election year, the government will now always be expected to have a role in business. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
In the business of Wall Street today, all three major indices finished in the red. Details, numbers, when we get there. European markets have been a bit brighter the past week or so, mostly on hopes that the European Central Bank is going to ride to the debt crisis rescue once and for all in this whole thing. It does prompt us to ask, though, as we sometimes do.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? We go to Madrid today and to Miguel Ancho Morado to see how the Spanish are really feeling about things. Miguel, it's good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
So first of all, I guess, how's the mood? I mean, sentiment over here seems to be a little bit, hey, Europe's not doing so bad right now.
Well, interestingly enough, in Spain, this news about the ECB scheme to save the euro has been received with some concern and even with apprehension.
Really? Apprehension? It's going to save the euro and that's a bad thing?
Well, it's not a bad thing if it saves the euro, but maybe not a good thing for Spain, for the reason that Spain has to request a full bailout in order to enjoy this scheme devised by Mr. Mario Draghi.
Yeah, the head of the ECB, yeah.
That's a problem, because the bailout will stigmatize the Spanish economy. And then there's another problem, and is that this help comes with the strings attached.
The more important question, though, is how's the mood of the people? I mean, obviously, it seems they're not all that happy.
Well, the people is mostly worried about the unemployment. Of course, the unemployment figure, 25%. We keep repeating this figure because it's so staggering.
Yeah, yeah.
But then also because of the response, which comes basically in the form of cutbacks of, well, everything, you name it, the education, everything has been affected by the austerity program. And people are now beginning to feel the pain of it. And in fact, we are preparing ourselves, we're bracing for a very difficult autumn in which lots of industrial actions, strikes, protests are already in store.
You'll forgive me, but this sounds a little bit like Greece of a year ago, which nobody really enjoyed.
Well, the sorts of solutions that the European Union and the Spanish government now are implementing are quickly approaching us to Greece in a certain sense, because the response of the population is becoming increasingly like that of Greece. We don't have the same problems, but we have the same solutions. And maybe implementing the same solutions, we will end up with the same problems as well.
What about you? I mean, day to day, do you feel this?
Well, of course, I suffer all these tax races and all these deterioration of the economy very much.
But can you, say, go out for a nice meal with friends? I mean, is that something you're still willing and able to do?
Well, it depends on your mood and on your nature. Mine is that I will go out with my friends no matter what. Yeah. And if the crisis deepens, well, then an additional reason to do that.
Miguel Ancho Morado, we reached him in Madrid. Miguel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Even if you've somehow managed not to pay real close attention yet to the presidential race, you probably know money is the story in politics this year. Just today, the two presidential campaigns released their monthly fundraising totals. Suffice it to say, there are a lot of zeros involved. And political money gathering is something a lot of people and groups want to be involved with. For the first time this year, that list includes the Divine Nine, the collective name given to the nine oldest black fraternities and sororities in this country. Their political action committee, their PAC, is called Unity Nine, and their alumni list has around 3 million names on it. It's a who's who of influential African Americans in business, in entertainment, and in politics, as Ann Hepperman reports.
So why did Unity 9 founder Sam Hamilton start a PAC? It simply says, because politics is a money game.
If you're in the fight, you've got to bring all that you have with you, including your pocketbook.
But just because you start a PAC doesn't mean the money's going to automatically roll in. Unity 9 hopes to raise $1 million by the end of the year, which is why they're here at a Divine 9 alumni picnic outside of Hartford, Connecticut, and why Kappa alumni and Hartford City Council member Kyle Anderson has interrupted the barbecue and the music to get the PAC's message out.
Folks, I know this is a social gathering, but we just don't party. We party with a purpose. So we need to understand that it's a political PAC.
that can push the agenda that we have on a national level forward.
Afterward, Anderson jokes that his little speech probably didn't bring in millions of dollars.
Do you think you just raised $10,000 right there?
If not, we raised a couple dollars.
But he did end up convincing AKA sorority sister Naima Pinkney to donate.
The Unity 9 PAC has an opportunity to put our money where everyone else has been placing theirs, because in the 60s, if you had a million people stand together and say, hey, we'd like to be heard, you got heard. Now, if you have one person with $100 million, they get heard. It's just that simple.
The Divine Nines had a long tradition of social and political activities. Members rode in the Freedom Rides in the 60s, helped desegregate schools, and did Get Out the Vote campaigns. And their alumni list is like a page out of a civil rights history book. Jesse Jackson Sr., Omega Psi Phi. Maya Angelou, Alpha Kappa Alpha. And Martin Luther King?
America has given the Negro people a bad check.
He was Alpha Phi Alpha.
But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt.
But for the most part, the Divine Nine has stuck to grassroots movements, even in the way that they raise money. Dr. Frederick Harris directs the Institute for African American Research at Columbia University.
When there is a candidate running, for instance, people would go to places like the Black Church and pass around the hat, as they did when Jesse Jackson ran in 1984 and 1988.
But Harris says the Unity 9 PAC could change that.
And so here we are 20 years later, and we have the founding of this PAC by very important Black sororities and fraternities who are a part of the echelon of Black professionals in this country. And one would hope that they would use these PACs to put on the agenda very important issues that affect Black communities.
PAC founder Sam Hamilton agrees. Hamilton says with money comes respect and, more importantly, access. It's the difference between getting an appointment with a junior staffer or a face-to-face meeting with a congressman so you can say,
Congressman, these are our issues, as opposed to, will you pass this on to the congressman?
But Hamilton says even though this PAC is a step forward, some things haven't changed. After he filed paperwork with the FEC, a letter came to his office. He opened it and was taken aback by what he read.
You're part of that group that should be annihilated, like Martin Luther King and this and that.
Hamilton says it was a cold reminder of the hatred that still exists. But oddly enough, he was emboldened.
That was the first indication that this must have some power to it if within 1 month that you start this, something like that comes back.
Just how much power Unity 9 will have in the future is still up in the air. They've donated to campaigns across the country, but the PAC is still relatively small. Its largest political contribution to date is $1,000. And of their $1 million end-of-the-year goal, Unity 9's only raised $150,000. But Hamilton says he's okay with that.
Maybe you don't win the fight, but you're going to be in the fight, period.
Because the first step is getting into the game. In New York, I'm Ann Hepperman for Marketplace.
Coming up, did you go to the movies last weekend?
They were all just meh films, I mean, very honestly.
Yeah, I thought so, too. Might explain why they're making meh money, right? But first, let's do the numbers. And so, nagging worries over Europe, lingering questions over stimulus from the Fed. Boom, you got the Dow off 0.33%, 52 points, 13,254 the final reading today. The NASDAQ dropped 1%, 32 points, 3,104 at the close. The S&P 500 trimmed off more than 0.5%. That's 8 points, the number there. Come on, guess. All right, now, 1429. Tech stocks were among the biggest drags today. Intel shares suffered from Friday's report that revenue was going to be lower than anticipated. That left the chipmaker as the worst performer among the blue chips, down almost 4%. Microsoft shares lost 0.75% today. Bond prices edged higher. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus slipped to 1.65%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. Events around the country mark the anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade and goods and services for July. And hold your pet bunny close. 25 years ago, the movie Fatal Attraction premiered. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The American war on drugs and Mexico's problems with gun violence met up today in Washington. What's being called a caravan for peace has been traveling this country the past month or so, trying to draw attention to the violence down in Mexico. The activists, a lot of them anyway, in that caravan are family members who've been killed down there. And they're asking Washington to change the way it goes after drug traffickers, in part by targeting the American gun industry. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Javier Cecilia is a respected poet from Mexico with a personal connection to the war on drugs.
It's an absurd, stupid war. It kills innocent people like my son.
About 70,000 people have been murdered in Mexico since 2006. American activist John Lindsay Poland says most of the Mexican victims were killed with guns smuggled from the U.S.
In Mexico in the last 5 years, there are about 100,000 firearms that have been recovered at crime scenes, and more than two-thirds of them were sold by dealers legally, commercially in the United States.
He says many of the AK-47s used in Mexico are manufactured in Romania, then imported to the U.S. and smuggled across the border. The group is calling on President Obama to enforce an existing law prohibiting the import of foreign assault weapons. It's a small step, but one the president has the power to make.
We're urging the White House to take action because it's so important to do something soon, even if it doesn't solve all of the problems.
The group also wants the government to pony up extra funds for more oversight. As you might expect, gun dealers tend to see the issue differently. At this firing range in Las Vegas, gun enthusiasts shoot machine guns. The company, called The Gun Store, also sells machine guns. Owner Bob Irwin says gun dealers don't need more regulations.
I have two people in my store full-time do nothing but paperwork for the United States government. It's an incredibly regulated industry.
He says restricting gun ownership for law-abiding citizens is un-American. That argument doesn't carry much weight with poet Javier Cecilia.
The spirit of the Second Amendment refers to defensive weapons, but the arms being sold are for exterminating people. I don't think assault weapons are covered by the Second Amendment.
That's the sound of an assault weapon being cut in half. Members of the Peace Caravan bought it at a gun show in Houston. John Lindsay Poland describes a visit to another gun show in Albuquerque.
One member of the caravan went up to a dealer and said, "Can I buy as many of these assault weapons as I want?" And he said yes. And she said, "And if I wanted to get them into another country, for example, into Mexico, would I be able to do that?" And he said, "Well, I couldn't do that for you, but we know people who can."
The Peace Caravan is asking gun dealers along the border to voluntarily stop selling assault weapons. Hector Garcia runs a gun store in El Paso called Countrywide Shooters. I asked if he would consider not selling assault weapons.
No. Why hurt the people that live next to the border? I mean, they'll just go somewhere else. They'll just go up to Oklahoma.
Garcia sees the violence in Mexico as a result of supply and demand.
If you could cut down from the usage of narcotics in the United States, eliminate half of the market, you know, you could eliminate a lot of the violence that goes down south.
That's one of the few points on which both sides agree. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today's news about the Treasury Department selling off its stake in AIG is perhaps an unwelcome reminder of the way in which taxpayers got its stake in AIG, a financial crisis the likes of which this country hasn't seen in 80 years. Scott Nelson talks about that crisis and the eight or so other big ones we've had in this country since we've been a country in his new book. It's called, wait for this, you're going to love it, A Nation of Deadbeats. Scott, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to take issue with the title for a second.
Yes.
I get that it's provocative and you got to sell books and all that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that the way this country has grown is by borrowing, is by credit, is by leverage, if I could use a dirty word.
Yes.
And it's a little tricky to say, well, maybe we ought not do that, right?
No, I think it's you're right. I had my own reservations about the title. Yeah. Nation of Deadbeats, partly what I'm trying to call attention to is precisely what you say, that the U.S. could not have existed as the U.S. without lots and lots of borrowing. The U.S. separates from Britain in the Revolution and then borrows from Britain and the rest of Europe for 200 years. The U.S. could not have settled in California, could not have settled in Texas. It could not have done any of the expansion that took place so rapidly without a great deal of borrowing. The thing is that we don't pay. And there are lots and lots of times where Americans don't pay. And those are the crises that are at the heart of not just the American economic system, but at the heart of American politics.
Yeah. What do you think of the what has happened since 2007, 2008? We had a financial crisis started largely in this country, which has turned into a sovereign debt crisis largely in Europe.
Let me go back to another panic I think that's a whole lot like this one. That's the Panic of 1837. In that one, it's cotton. That's the central problem. Lots and lots of people default on these – as cotton prices drop, they default on those debts. There's a massive collapse. The way that a bunch of states in the United States back their way out of this crisis is by issuing lots and lots of sovereign debt. And now, as the first payments are due, it's become clear that those debts are not payable. And what happens in the U.S. is that 7 or 8 states all defaulted in 1841. It's, John Quincy Adams was very angry about Mississippi's not paying its debts in 1841. And he had suggested removing all U.S. gunboats from the Mississippi River to allow British creditors to send in their own gunboats and collect
the debts
that that's Mississippi
great.
Wouldn't pay.
Wow.
And that's the same crisis that we're seeing in the EU now, is Angela Merkel and others saying we have an EU, we have the euro, but we have this sort of semi-sovereignty.
This is a historical book. It's a survey of America's financial disasters. And if you read the list of them in the introduction to this book, there's a whole bunch in the 1800s, and then there's 1929, and then there's nothing until 2008. I mean, you'd have thought we had this figured out, right?
You'd have thought. And I think that that's part of it, that long gap between 1929 and 2007 led lots of economists to believe that they had figured it all out. We just need to do this. We just need to do that. There are simple things that resolve these financial panics. So there's no reason to study them anymore. Anybody kind of trained after, say, 1964, 65 in economics doesn't really know anything about the other financial panics. It's not taught anymore.
Well, you know, the one that most people have studied, including, by the way, Ben Bernanke, is the Depression and 1929. He wrote his PhD thesis on that famously.
Right.
And those are the comparisons we've heard for the past 4 or 5 years. Are those apt comparisons, though?
No, 1929 is a terrible model in a way for this crisis. What we had in the U.S. was lots and lots of consumer debt, lots and lots based in the U.S., lots and lots of foreign lenders. But all the other crises that we've had in the United States, all the other financial crises, have been American borrowers and lenders, mostly in Europe. And that it's mostly been consumer debt that's been at the heart of those crises. So 2007 actually looks like every other crisis except 1929.
Yeah. Scott Nelson. His book is called A Nation of Deadbeats. He teaches history at the College of William & Mary. Scott, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you so much.
Life imitated art this past weekend. The horror film The Possession led at the box office, which is fitting because Hollywood has had a truly horrific summer. Domestic ticket sales were down 4% from last year, and this past weekend was Hollywood's worst since right after September 11th. So we asked Marketplace and Nancy Marshall-Genzer to find out what's going on.
The number one reason Hollywood flopped this summer, the movies were awful.
They were all just meh films, I mean, very honestly.
That's Keith Simonton. He's the managing editor of the online movie site IMDb. He says some of the bombs had big-name stars. Ben Stiller in The Watch, Adam Sandler in That's My Boy.
He also had things like Rock of Ages, the Tom Cruise musical vehicle.
Wait, what did he just say?
The Tom Cruise musical vehicle.
Yep, I did hear him right. Tom Cruise musical. Brace yourself. Okay, that pretty much sums up just how bad the summer movies were. But the economy played a supporting role. Claude Brodesser-Ackner is West Coast editor for Vulture.com. He says people would rather download something than waste a night out on a flop.
You don't have to worry about, you know, sticky floors or hiring babysitters, and you certainly don't have to pay the kinds of prices that are being demanded for product that was decidedly inferior this summer.
But Hollywood says it'll put out a better product over the upcoming holiday season. Paul Dergarabedian is a box office analyst at Hollywood.com.
But we've got Resident Evil Retribution in 3D and IMAX on the way.
The last installment of the Twilight series is also on the way, and there's a new James Bond film. If they're not any good, moviegoers might be doling out some retribution of their own at the box office. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of, oh, come on, can we stop with the iPhone 5 stuff already? There's a research note out from JPMorgan Chase today about said phone. It figures the thing, which, as we all know, is going to be released on Wednesday, could add between a quarter and a half percentage point to fourth quarter GDP. That is not nothing, my friends, given that GDP is probably going to be around 2% or so. The math goes like this. 8 million phones, J.P. Morgan says it's going to sell. At $600 a whack retail, you factor out the cost of goods sold, make some adjustments for international trade, and there you go with this caveat. Salt, grain of, use one. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off a third of 1%, 52 points. The NASDAQ down 1%, 32 points. The S&P 500 trimmed away more than a half a percent. That is 8 points. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, and David Weinberg. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.